The Rambam has a unique formulation with regard to what is required for a person to obtain a share, so to speak, in Olam Haba, the world to come. The Rambam maintains that the ultimate punishment, reward that God grants to the righteous for keeping the mitzvot is not anything which can be obtained in this earthly existence. The Rambam expresses this idea in the Laws of Tshuva in the 9th chapter, in the 8th chapter, where he says that the good that is stored up for the righteous is the life of the world to come. And that is the life that does not partake of death, which is to say, it's eternal. And it is the good which does not contain within it any evil. Then he cites sources in scripture to support this. As it says, "Uman yitav loch," in order that it be good for you, "V'harachta yavim," and you'll have length of days. The basic idea, the context, is that one should keep the Torah, and if one keeps the Torah, "Uman yitav loch," that it should be good for you, and you should have length of days. So the Rambam is saying, this supports his position about Olam Haba, the world to come. First of all, it should be pointed out that there's a primary meaning, plain meaning of the verse. And then, of course, the verse can be alluding to certain things. That's part of the method of Torah, that it communicates a plain message, and you have to understand what the plain message is. Then, by way of allusion, it's alluding to other things. The secondary levels of meaning are pretty much things that we ourselves couldn't figure out. That requires a great deal of proficiency. A person has to be a master of all of Torah, and especially the oral law, to know what there are certain principles in Judaism that are not stated outright in the Torah, and they've been transmitted to us by means of the oral law. However, thus, the primary way of knowing about it is the oral law. That is not to say, however, that there are not verses that allude and support. So there are many doctrines of Judaism that are not stated openly in the written law. Such a case is this doctrine of the world to come, which is a fundamental tenet of Judaism. A person is obligated to believe in the phenomenon. And that's passed down to us through the oral law. But the Ram is citing this pasuk. He's citing a verse. The basic idea of the verse, however, is that it's teaching another idea, which is in line with this. If we go to the source in the Chumash, it's in Devarim, chapter 22, verse 7. That specific pasuk. But, of course, one should look at the context. The context is an interesting mitzvah, which is referred to as Kan Sipor, a situation where one encounters a bird's nest, and the mother is sitting on the chicks. That is, a mother bird and its chicks. And you want to take the chicks. So it's a very interesting kind of law. That is, it prohibits a person from taking the babies, the chicks, in the presence of the mother. But rather, one has to send away the mother, and when the mother is not there, you take away the chicks. Then you can do that, because you're not inflicting that pain upon the mother. The pain of the mother witnessing the children being taken away from her. So that's something which is an instinctual reaction. That protective instinct that mothers have for their children, maybe this is a blow to people's sense of superiority or self-esteem, that's not something which is unique to human beings. That's something which can be found among animals. People tend to pride themselves for things which really they're not responsible for. A mother's devotion to her child. That's something which mothers take great pride in. And many of them never ever let the child forget about it. When the child grows up, how much they took care of the child when it was sick and what they did for the child and all of that. As though this were some act of great charity and compassion. When in point of fact, it's really rooted in a very powerful emotion. If the emotion is that powerful, so then it's not a reflection of your greatness. That's something you really were compelled to do. Not to do so would have been very painful. Does a person have a right to take credit and to present themselves as being a benefactor when in point of fact they were really motivated by very powerful emotions, ulterior motives? Everybody knows that if you're out in the forest, you're going hiking, and there's bears, if you see a bear, and a mother bear with its cubs, you stay away. That's when they're at their most dangerous. Because they're extremely protective of their cubs, and they'll fight to the death. Displaying every ounce of protectiveness and willing to endanger oneself, to put their life on the line to protect their children, their offspring, as any mother would do. It's interesting, one wouldn't expect to find this type of a law in the Torah or elsewhere. I don't know if there is any other culture or system or religion that has a similar kind of law. Most people tend to identify with certain things that they like in the Torah. That is, there are certain people that really like the fact that the Torah emphasizes the element of caring for others, helping others, or the elements of justice. Other people may be drawn to the prohibitions of the Torah, or the ritual aspect of Torah. And they're not that attracted to the elements of justice and ethics. It's interesting. You do see that different types of groups of Jews, of observant Jews, or observant up to a point, you can identify, they've identified, they've picked out certain things that they like. They don't display a different attitude, which is to say that it's not for us to decide which particular aspect of Torah, but every element of Torah is perfection, and we have to distribute our energies equally across the board. It's not for you to pick out one particular area and then spend your life in that area and sort of downplay the significance of the other area. That's not so important. A person doesn't have the right to do that. A truly perfected individual who is accepting Torah on the proper basis would recognize that this is the Word of God. This is the divine system, and it's perfectly geared in every area to lead a person to a certain goal. So it's not for us to sit in judgment. Of course, we have to study, and we question, and we want to understand, because the more we understand of Torah, the better will be our performance. We'll achieve the objective. It's recognized that to perform the Torah mindlessly is very limited gain that you can get from it. The point is being made that this law does not constitute as big a surprise as the law pertaining to a captive woman. That seems to be a bigger surprise. I would agree with that. Because there you're in a situation where we already have something which is a prohibition. The Gentile woman is prohibited. And it's a significant prohibition. And the Torah is making an exception to the rules. And it's stated clearly that it's a concession to the evil inclination, to the Yetzer Hara. In recognition of the fact that, for whatever reason, we're not going into it right now, the soldier at that point in time would not be amenable to listening to the voice of reason and to controlling his instinct. So that we find ourselves in a strange situation that the Torah is basically opposed to it. There are cases where the Torah is opposed to it. It's not a good idea. But if you insist, you're not going to be under the ban of a prohibition. That's essentially what we learn in the case of a captive woman. This case is not such a huge surprise. Let's ask the question from a different angle. there are certain laws of the Torah which are referred to as the so-called irrational laws. We maintain that all the laws are rational, and that those laws, which on the surface may not, their rationality, the purpose may not be evident, but if you study deeply, you'll find that they have a reason, a very significant reason. We're talking about a category of laws, however, where the rationality manifests itself in that if the Torah had not ordained it, people would discover the necessity for such laws by themselves. The laws pertaining, prohibiting injury, theft, the laws of theft, thou shalt not steal. That concept didn't originate with Torah. Any rational group of people that wanted to set up a society would be able to figure that out themselves, that you can't allow people to just go and steal. You won't have any basis for society. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. These things are determined by human reason. A sane society would have these laws. And thus many other laws of the Torah, that if the Torah hadn't commanded it, we would see the wisdom of it ourselves. So let me ask that question. Had the Torah not commanded it, would we have ordained this law ourselves? To set up the question, we could ask another question, another issue. Would human reason, of its own accord, establish rules to prevent us from being cruel to animals? This is a specific prohibition, but it's known that the Torah prohibits cruelty to animals. The chief heading under which that falls, I suppose, would be the law that applies to Noahides as well. It's called Avram and Achai, that you cannot remove a limb from a living animal in order to eat it. That is, you have to first kill the animal properly. So you're not allowed to practice any cruelty to animals. The concept is expressed as Tsar Balei Chayim, inflicting pain on animals. So let's ask ourselves the question whether that category itself is something that human reason would have arrived at of its own, or is that something which requires revelation from God? Question is, what is the underlying basis in Judaism for the prohibition against inflicting pain on animals? Now, let's say somebody makes the following case and says that there's a difference between mistreatment of human life, of people, as opposed to animals, and that the reason why we're prohibited from inflicting pain and suffering on fellow humans, aside from the practical issue that you can't have an orderly society in which people go about hurting each other and all the consequences, aside from that, it's inherently wrong because a human being partakes of a divine element, the soul, the Tzelem Elokim, and the person was created in order to achieve a purpose, and therefore it's a very complicated mechanism. A person has a psyche, and once you inflict pain upon a human being, it has very serious consequences. It's not just a matter of the pain, the physical pain, even if the pain goes away once the person is healed, but it has a scar upon the psyche of the person. And therefore, you're interfering in a serious way with the ability of that person to develop naturally and freely and to achieve the purpose for which he or she was created. That would be rooted in the fact that it's Tzelem Elokim, that this is a special being who's been endowed with the divine, so to speak, soul. And that's the reason why the Torah is very strict, to the point that verbal abuse, as we've learned, you're not allowed to insult people verbally, and that's a very serious sin. It's based upon the same idea, because you're inflicting a harm. That the human being has such a delicate psychic structure and mechanism that all of these things have to be functioning properly, and if you interfere with that, you're deflecting the person from their purpose. Now, when you're talking about animals, and we're assuming that they don't have the same soul, obviously, they're physical, they're instinctual, and that's to be seen, that it is permitted to treat them, to discipline them, to train them, and in doing so you'll sometimes hit them, yell at them, and so on and so forth, and that'll improve their behavior. But and they don't suffer from neuroses and things of that sort, because it's a much simpler kind of a mechanism. So if one has that basis, that foundation, that there is a tremendous gap, a tremendous difference between the human and the animal, unlike what many people believe today, that man is just a more sophisticated animal. We're not working with that premise. What then would be the philosophical or ethical basis for a prohibition against inflicting pain on an animal? Question being raised, why am I saying that in order to prohibit inflicting pain, it has to be because of the effect, that it will impede a person in their ability to fulfill their purpose? That's a good question. I'm saying I think that has to be the case. Let's assume a person who is completely involved in evil things. No constructive aspect, a Nazi or a mafioso. Someone, all of whose energies is devoted towards evil. And you insult that person. And that person feels a momentary pain of the insult. What did you do wrong? Don't you have to... The mere fact that this person experiences pain, so why is that a bad? Why is that an evil in the world? Don't you have to have some type of a context? What is the basis, the moral basis, that makes the fact that this person is experiencing pain an evil? To the contrary, many people might think that, no, it's good for a Nazi to feel pain. This person is not entitled to any good feeling. That is to say, that in order to say that it's evil to inflict pain or suffering, it presupposes that the one you're doing it to has a certain right to a certain tranquility, the right to tranquility. Because I want the basis for that is because it's only in that state that I can possibly fulfill my purpose. I was endowed with that right to tranquility, which you are now interfering with. But once a person loses that right to tranquility because they're violating the terms in which it's been established, so then all bets are off. My point is that if as a result of pain that you inflict on an individual, there are no immoral consequences, no consequences that go contrary to morality, and we're just merely talking about the fact that a living being experiences pain, that in and of itself would not render it immoral or wrong. The basic explanation, one should consult the Ramban, that is Nachmanides' commentary on this verse, to be found in his commentary on the Torah, to the effect that the law pertaining to the mother and the chicks, the basis of the prohibition is that the human beings, man, should not practice cruelty. From the standpoint of a human being, this would be cruelty. That is to say, because the animal does experience pain when this occurs. So the reason for the prohibition is not so much that the Torah went out of its way to protect the animal from experiencing this pain. Now it seems to me that if rational people got together and they were making laws and they considered something like this, they might not institute it as a law. I think the average person who in general would be concerned, would not want to be inhumane to animals, wouldn't regard this as being so terrible a pain. It seems that small, it seems petty. That's another factor. When you legislate and you prohibit something, before it becomes a prohibition, it has to be of some significance. It has to have a significant impact. So that there are certain things that you ought not to do. You shouldn't annoy somebody. But we don't regard a minor annoyance as being a prohibition, as opposed to pushing the person or to insulting the person. Before you prohibit something, it has to have a certain character to it, a certain quality. It has to have a certain significance. Then there are lesser things that fall below the line of the prohibition that you shouldn't do. It exhibits a bad character, but you can't say that just because you did it, you already violated. You can't insult somebody. But sometimes whistling in somebody's presence is annoying. But no one's going to say that if you do that, you violate the law of the Torah. It falls under a different heading. That good midos, a person should have good character traits and should be sensitive to others and so forth. This is the kind of thing where it's possible to say it's true. We can understand that the animals have maternal instincts and there's going to be a certain amount of pain. But how long does it take? I think the average individual would do it and move on, and recognizing that the animal doesn't really remember. And time will heal that wound. It's interesting. That's, from that standpoint, an advantage that animals have that humans don't. In that humans have memory. So that's another factor to consider before inflicting any kind of a pain or an insult upon humans, is that it doesn't go away quickly. It may not ever go away because they remember. Whereas with an animal, the effect is pretty limited, and they adjust. Animals have an amazing capacity to adjust to the new situation. And thus you'll see that animals that have been hurt, and let's say one of their dogs, let's say one of its legs was broken. So of course it's going to be painful, but once that physical pain is gone and they adapt to the situation, they continue. They don't brood. They don't remember. And they don't have the question of why did this happen to me. They're just affected by the reality of the moment. Whereas for people, even after the fact, and even if they could have adjusted to certain things, they can't adjust because they can't accept that it could have happened to them in the first place. And you find that with people that have handicaps. There's different mentalities. Some people, amazingly, accept the fact, they adapt to it, and then they develop the techniques that enable them to get beyond the handicap, and turns out that they achieve more than they ever would have achieved in the first place. But other people don't. Other people brood about it. And they could have the same capacity. They may have the same potential to overcome it, but they can't put the energy into doing it because all the energy is consumed with the inability to accept how this could have happened. And they spend the rest of their lives how this could have happened. That's a very major point. There are a lot of people that do not fulfill all the potential that they have in terms of life. Do not capitalize because they can't accept certain disappointments. And it's true, they may have had an opportunity and they were disappointed or something happened to them and so on and so forth. But then say, okay, but let's look at what you can have now. And there's plenty that they can have now. But they cannot live in the now. They can't make use of the now. To live in the now means to just drop that and put all your energy into what I could do now. And they can't do that. Whereas others accept the fact that was then, that's over, let me look at what I have now. And they put all their energy into now, and they find out that they can have a very good situation in the now. The difference between animals and humans is that animals only have the now. They don't have any other reality to compare it to. And they don't look at the other dog and say, how come this dog doesn't have any defect and I have a defect? Because that's not reality for them. They don't even have that reality. That's another thing that plagues humans. That they have other realities. They can't enjoy the reality that they're in. They can't make full use of it because they have other realities that they think they'd rather be in. And they can't accept it. They feel abused because they're not in that reality. That reality can be something from the past, which doesn't exist anymore, so it's all in the mind. The other reality could be a fantasy of what they think they ought to have. So they're comparing what they actually do have to something which is a fantasy. Or they could look around at what their friends or other people have, and they to adopt that as the reality that they ought to have, but it's not their reality any more than the dog looks at other dogs, and your reality is what you have. What somebody else has is not your reality, has no bearing on your reality. That's the idea, of course, of not to be envious, to covet. Losachmod. What I think is unique about the law pertaining to the bird and the mother and the chicks is that it displays tremendous sensitivity to this, a situation which most people would just ignore and overlook. Wouldn't stop, wouldn't take the trouble. There's cases, there's an overt situation. To beat a dog, a defenseless dog, that's an overt thing. Everybody notices that. That makes an impact on everybody. This seems to be small and trivial to the extent that, and all right, maybe if you have the time, it's nice, but the fact that the animal had to undergo this type of a pain, that's not something which makes an impact upon people. It's also true that it's something that we really can't measure. There's no way that people can measure all the different pains that are inflicted on animals other than physical ones. A pain that it has on the emotions of the animal. That's very hard to measure. But the Torah determined that this should be the case. So it's a very interesting law. It's a very humbling law. It humbles a person to realize that you don't have any power. You don't have any control. You have to humble yourself before the needs of this particular bird. And that's different than saying you can't rip a limb off an animal, because that's not humbling. That's not such a humbling thought. Because most people's emotions are in line with that. But this is something which displays tremendous sensitivity, and people are in a hurry, and you're humbled. You now have to respect the emotions of the bird, the mother bird. Thus, it's to inculcate within us a very refined level of compassion. Now you see a new element that comes into the picture. There's different degrees of compassion. There's different components to compassion. What is the specific component that's being emphasized in this particular law? There are reasons why people sometimes don't act in a compassionate way. It's not always because they're lacking in compassion. Sometimes the person will not act in a compassionate way in a specific situation, whereas you could say that this person in general does have compassion. And then upon investigation, you'll find out that the person wasn't aware. They were lacking in a certain sensitivity. That is, when you bring something to a person's attention, so then they recognize that they have to act in a certain way, or they have to avoid another way. But then there are certain people that have a sensitivity, and they don't always need to be told. They have a certain sensitivity to the needs of others. What this is teaching us is that compassion in general and sensitivity specifically are not just things that you're born with, that are innate and are not subject to cultivation. One ought to cultivate within oneself the sensitivity, the compassion for others. Now, of course, the virtue of compassion is not to be equated directly with the emotion of compassion. That is not the same thing. When a person does compassion purely because of emotional responses, that's good. That's a good quality. But in and of itself, it doesn't represent the virtue, because that's your emotion. Your emotion is forcing you to do it. And you're getting emotional gratification. It doesn't necessarily reflect virtue. It means to say your emotions may be in the right place. But bear in mind that the exact same emotion, if it's not under the control of reason and intelligence, can cause you to do things that are very destructive. If you exhibit compassion in situations where it's not called for, it can embolden evil people to just continue. I mean, the history of mankind, the history of evil, has as much to do with false compassion, misdirected compassion, enabling evil people to perpetrate their harm. However, there are two different areas of perfection that a person has to work on. as the Rambam says, the ultimate means, the ultimate medium of perfection is knowledge. I want to read something from the Mora, the Guide for the Perplexed. And this is in the section where the Rambam deals with the evils of the world. This is on page 267 in the paperback. It's an amazing statement. It's a short chapter. All the great evils which men cause to each other because of certain intentions, desires, opinions, or religious principles are likewise due to non-existence because they originate in ignorance, which is absence of wisdom. A blind man, for example, who has no guide, stumbles constantly because he cannot see and causes injury and harm to himself and others. In the same manner, various classes of men, each man in proportion to his ignorance, bring great evils upon themselves and upon other individual members of the species. If men possessed wisdom, which stands in the same relation to the form of man as the sight to the eye, they would not cause any injury to themselves or to others. For the knowledge of truth removes hatred and quarrels and prevents mutual injuries. This state of society is promised to us by the prophet in the words, "And the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the cow and the bear shall feed together," etc. "And the sucking child shall play on the hole of the asp." Now, the Rambam does not take these statements which pertain to the Messianic era literally, because the Rambam maintains that there will not be a change in the laws of nature. So animals will have the same nature that they have now. It's a metaphor referring to interactions between people, that people will no longer act in a violent way, in an aggressive way, and the world will not be a constant stage of warfare and competition. Peace, universal peace. The prophet also points out what will be the cause of this change. For he says that hatred, quarrel, and fighting will come to an end, because men will then have a true knowledge of God. "They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea." You could see from this that the entire world, or a significant part of the world today, is occupied with the whole idea of peace and resolving conflict. And pretty much the whole method is to try and preach that there should be acceptance and democracy and freedom and tolerance of others, that type of approach. But you see that it's all futile, that it can't work, according to what the Rambam is saying. Nobody ever stops to think that the only way this can be achieved is through genuine knowledge. That is, if people had a genuine knowledge of the good, not just in an intellectual way, where they could say it over. The Rambam's concept of knowledge is that it forms the basis of the person's conviction, their emotional convictions. They believe that all of their emotional energy is attached to that which reason dictates to be true. So they live in accordance with truth. If they live in accordance with truth, so that it would eliminate all of the hatred and the warfare. It's all based upon a false idea of what the good is. Thus we can answer the question that I posed, what is the greatest tragedy? Or the greatest evil? Is the fact that mankind does not recognize the idea of truth. Because there's no one today that maintains this idea that the truth is of this kind of significance. There's no religion that maintains this idea. And that's why, as I mentioned, the true compassion, which is displayed by Avraham, is not just in helping people physically, but in helping people in terms of the truth. He sought to free mankind from error and to show them the truth. Without the truth, their life has no purpose. It has no It's like a blind person that's stumbling. Cannot achieve his objective without the truth. This is the way he's constructed. Yet that idea of the centrality of truth, mankind today recognizes truth in different areas. The only area where they recognize something which we could call an objective truth is in the physical sciences, where it's empirical data, where it can be experimental, where you could prove it, so to speak, in a physical kind of a way. But where it comes to an abstract realm, the way of life, purpose of life, what's good, what's evil, these types of questions, which are, of course, the most essential questions to the existence of man. The other questions pertain to man's need, but they don't pertain to man's purpose. In this area, people abandon the whole idea of truth and maintain that there's no truth, that it's subjective. It's all based upon emotion. And in religion, too. There's no religion aside from Judaism which makes the claim that the salvation of man is dependent upon knowledge. So the greatest evil is that the world, and I'm basing this on my interpretation of the Rambam, that the world is committed to living in a state of blindness. From a purely physical standpoint, it would be akin to, on a physical level, where people could deal with the problem of blindness if they decided to do so, but don't recognize the evil of blindness and deny that there's such a thing as sight, or that sight is a worthwhile goal to obtain. That's the attitude that people have towards knowledge, and that, I maintain, is the ultimate evil. Getting back now to the source that we started with, it turns out that the source that the Rambam selects as one which alludes to the world to come is in connection with the law pertaining to sending away the mother, not to take the chicks with the mother present. So verse 7 says, you shall send away the mother, and then you may take the children, in order that it be good for you and that you have length of days. It's making a very, very significant point. It fits in line with the Ramban's particular interpretation, but in order that it be good to you, for you, is a reference to obedience. It's something which defines the entire Torah. That is to say that one should never, ever think that he's doing the mitzvot, fulfilling the Torah, because he wants to do something for God, that God derives any type of benefit. That's a blasphemous thought. That all of the intent, the objective, the benefit of all the mitzvot is that it be good for you. That's the essence of Torah. That God does not need our worship. God does not need our existence. As the Rambam points out at the beginning of Yesodei HaTorah, that if one could imagine that everything else in the world would cease to exist, God would exist, because God is the real existence. God is true existence. And we don't have real existence. It's a sobering thought. We don't have real existence. We exist only, whatever existence we have is because the will of God relates to us. And only insofar as God's will relates to us do we have existence. We're completely dependent. That, I believe, is also the basis of the true idea of fear of God. Fear of God means a person is constantly aware of the fact that he really only exists because of God. That a person tends to forget that. He tends to think that he's independent. He's an independent being. And he has significance, and he has control, and he has rights, and he can... It's up to him, really. That's what people, mankind does have the feeling that we are the masters of the world. We are the masters of our destiny. That is opposite to the feeling of fear of God, a certain awe. That you don't have anything. We're not even involved in the decision as to whether you would exist or not. That's in Pirkei Avos, Bal Korchach Atachai. The fact that you live has nothing to do with you. It's against your will, and Bal Korchach Atameis, and you're going to die. It's something outside of yourself. So you got to reorient yourself completely to be in line with this truth. That's basically the point that's being made over here. on a literal level. The literal meaning is to convey that the primary result, benefit of the Torah is you will have the best kind of life in this world and length of days. The person lives intelligently and is able to conform to control their emotions and to obtain the wisdom that they can live their life in accordance with the Torah, that'll have the best possible life in this world. Now, by way of allusion, it's referring to something else, which the Rambam then goes on to cite. Therefore, one could not derive the idea of the world to come just from these verses alone. Plain meaning is, doesn't require any further explanation. A good life and length of days. Length of days does not necessarily have to refer to endless. However, by means of the oral law, it's been taught to us, it's been revealed to the Jews, that the real, the ultimate reward is something more than that. That our existence, when God gave us existence, and we don't have existence except by virtue of God, He gave us the means to eternal existence. So when we talk about the fact that death is inevitable, we're talking in terms of physical existence, this life. And this particular pasuk is referring by allusion. The secret meaning of the pasuk is conveying that as a result of doing the mitzvos, and it's of course very, very interesting, one could say why this particular mitzvah is associated. That's another question. We don't always know why the teaching, by way of allusion, was stated in this context. Perhaps we can see something there, perhaps we don't, but whatever. It's a reference to eternity. And that contains two ideas, that the true reward is eternal, and it's perfectly good. Those are the two elements. The next question that should be taken up is that the Rambam described the world to come with two attributes. One is that it is eternal, and that's something that we can understand. We understand the idea of eternal, meaning without end. Doesn't require anything further. But he said it's the good that doesn't contain within it any evil. What does he mean by that? As opposed, of course, to the good in this world. I think the Rambam is making a very important point in that, given the nature of physical existence, when we use the term in this world, we refer to things as good and bad. We have different kinds of experiences. Pleasurable and unpleasurable. Happy and unhappy. Good and bad. It's used in a relative sense. It's very rare, maybe it doesn't even exist, that something is absolutely good. Whatever you think, whatever you look forward to, any joy that you have in this world is not pure. It has a lot of pain attached to it. And when you refer to it as good, it means after you've considered, relatively speaking, on the whole, there's more of the positive than the negative. As children, we're in search of an absolute situation. That's called fantasy. So when we think about it, we fantasize about what's going to be. We're going to get married. We're going to find that certain someone. We're going to be successful. We're going to have children. So in the fantasy, it's only perfect. You obliterate all of the negatives. But in truth, in life itself, it never works out that way. Of course, whatever good you find always contains things you don't like. It's impossible that it should be otherwise. And that has to do with anything and everything, whether it's a physical object. Well, mainly, I would say, in the realm of relationships, because pretty much man being a social animal, so all the goods that you search for has to do with others. And as soon as you involve others in it, it's already got problems. Everything's got problems. There's no such thing. And even if you want to look at a local, a particular thing, a great party, the wedding, any celebration, even if it's good, But you can't say that there was no... You think back about all the problems, the planning, the aggravation, the worry. It has to have all those things. And you say it was great. Yes, it was, because the way we understand that, we factor that in, and you do a calculation. And on the whole, what you're saying is that the good parts outweigh the bad. But to say that it is a good which didn't carry with it any bad or any negative, that's an impossibility. However, in the world to come, it's a completely different type of an experience of the good. It's something, as the Rambam will point out, that we can't even imagine. It's a purely good. It's an inherent good, which does not contain any elements of bad. Not to mention also that most of the human pleasures are not true pleasures. We experience it as pleasure, but when you break it down, it really has to do with the elimination of a pain. The pleasure of good company, to a large extent, has to do with the pain of loneliness. One that doesn't experience the pain of loneliness doesn't have the same experience of good company. The pleasure of eating is really the elimination of the pain of hunger. And there's always a conflict when you're eating, because the more you're satisfying yourself, the more you're diminishing the hunger. The less the pain of hunger, the less the enjoyment of the eating. And that's true with regard to virtually everything. Human relationships, friendships, any pleasure that you name along these lines, you'll always see that behind it is a state of pain that's being eliminated.